the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. One of the wishes Dodger fans might have this holiday is for a World Series win. I mean, it's been over three decades since the last one, which is nearly half the time since the Dodgers moved to L.A. Back in the mid-50s, it was a councilwoman in her early 20s who got the baseball rolling on bringing them here. We'll hear her story. Plus, we look ahead to 2020 when it comes to issues such as climate change and the challenges facing our infrastructure. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this December 24th. Happy holidays, everyone. Later on the show, we're going to meet a lady responsible for bringing the Dodgers to L.A.
There was no San Diego team at that point. There was no Oakland team. We really opened the West for baseball.
Our interview with Rosalind Wyman is coming up. Plus, we'll hear a story about the USO, that organization that entertains the troops. Though Bob Hope is no more, today's celebrities are carrying the torch. But is it still relevant? We're going to get to that at the end of our show. But we want to start off with a little bit of a look back at 2019 and a little bit of a look ahead to next year and the start of a whole new decade. I mean, crazy to think about that. The next few minutes will star KPCC's very own reporters who will join us to talk about their work on the issues they cover day in and day out. First up, we've got science reporter Jacob Margolis in the studio to talk about climate change, some of the highlights from this year, and also what to expect in 2020. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, A.
All right, so I was reluctant to say highlights because, you know, climate change is a catastrophe. It's a serious thing, but I do want to know how 2019 looked for California, just in terms of weather.
Okay, so just in terms of weather, which climate change is much more than that, but it started off on, dare I say, like a positive note. Because after 8 years of drought, we finally got enough rain to fill our reservoirs and snowpack and moisten everything up enough to pull us back to normal. And that rain fell until May, which was exceptional. And then everything dried up. We had slightly lower temperatures through the summer than we've had the past few years, which was a nice little reprieve, though they were still above average. And then it got really, really rough. As plants in our mountains dried to historic lows and we were hit with Santa Ana winds, the fire started in earnest in October, which was like, oh yeah, it's our climate future that we're dealing with now. And wildfires aren't uncommon for California, but obviously the conditions are exacerbated by massive green growth in the spring and then hot temperatures, you know, that dry everything out. So in terms of acres burned, though, it was actually far below recent years.
Because for a minute, it felt like it was a nonstop horror show of wildfires here in Southern California.
Absolutely. I've been thinking about that a lot, and I think it felt like the end of the world at times for kind of a few reasons. One, I think that we've become increasingly sensitive to wildfires as more and more people have come to recognize that they're a big part of our climate going forward. So they're looking for that signal. And so as of right now, you know, it's really only going to take a couple of maybe a dry month with heat wave and Santa Ana winds to kick up to start a major fire again, right? They're always on the horizon. And the other thing that I think is contributing to that apocalyptic feeling is these fires were in very populated areas where we've built into the wild. You know, the hillsides of the Palisades, Sylmar that butts up right against LA's National Forest. And remember, this fall, communities all over the state were dealing with blackouts as well. So now all of a sudden, even if there's no fire right at your house or it's not near you, you could still be dealing with this idea of the threat just constantly. It's impacting your life. And, you know, you might just lose power for a period of time. And that's a major inconvenience and a danger for some people. So each year, the threat of what our climate is changing into is like further solidified in the minds of Californians every time we have these extreme weather events.
And then a big part of this is how we deal with all of this, all the climate changes that are already happening, and then the threats ahead. What do you see as the biggest struggle for California?
Oh my God, numerous, right? I think they're all tough. Wildfires, heat waves, future drought. But one that I focused on recently is sea level rise. This summer, I dug into what the future of a very specific, iconic stretch of Pacific Coast Highway is going to look like, Malibu to Santa Monica. I grew up driving out there, surfing there. My dad did the same thing. And the future of them is bleak. It's all but certain that the vast majority of those beaches will be gone sometime in the next 80 years.
That's a blip. That's nothing. Wow.
Here's the thing, and this is what makes it really complicated. If there was no development, if there were no roads, railways, homes right along the water, the ocean would continue to erode the hills, new beaches would be created. But since that's not the case and all of those things are there, what do we do? Do we like continue to allow development? Do we push it back? Do we plan for 50 years down the line or just 10? And it raises all these questions like, what do we cherish? Do we cherish the public beaches and keeping those around, or do we prioritize homes and cities along the coast? Because to protect those homes, you'd have to put up seawalls, which would get rid of the beaches. It makes everything really hard.
Yeah, we talked about a lot of that stuff during our special week on climate coverage. That was earlier this fall. But remind us, how have coastal cities generally responded to this? Any decisions being made or officials kind of just sitting there just paralyzed?
In my opinion, and people might disagree with me, it feels like a state of paralysis. I think everyone's working very hard on how to respond, figuring out how to respond to this problem. But like I said, it's very complicated. And going forward, one case that I am watching is of Del Mar down near San Diego, because they're fighting the California Coastal Commission kind of like tooth and nail to not include the commission's definition of managed retreat in their future plan. Everyone's got to remember managed retreat, super sexy term. Basically, as sea levels rise, we end up moving homes and buildings and infrastructure back away from the water instead of building armament, instead of putting up seawalls. And whatever happens with that case, I feel like will be indicative of a lot of the other places in California and how their futures play out.
All right, so let's turn our attention now to 2020. What are you going to be watching out for?
All of the usual. Will drought come back? How about fire, temperature? But the biggest thing is obviously the election. Because if President Trump is elected, you can expect more of the same in terms of climate denial, reversing regulations. I mean, he's already worked to take us out of the Paris Climate Accords, rolled back Obama-era clean water regulations. He's challenging California's ability to set our own emission standards. Though many Americans and most Californians recognize that climate change is happening and they want to do something about it, which is a good thing, the Trump administration has gone in the opposite direction. I don't think it's unfair to argue that every moment that's not spent drawing down emissions and figuring out how to support, you know, everybody's well-being is another moment in the future that'll be lost to the ravages of our changing climate. And there's one last point that I want to make that I hope people keep in mind, especially in 2020. I want people to understand that climate change is not just about the weather. It's about housing and the economy and public health. Everything is connected. Lower income people are more likely to be impacted by high temperatures, worse air quality. Entire communities, like we said, along the coast will have to move. Our personal lives, what we know now, will change forever. As a reporter, I hope that I'm focused on that stuff, and I hope we can deliver that to you on LAist and KPCC, of course. But I think it's something good to keep in mind for folks going forward.
Now, Jacob, for people listening that are thinking, man, that's a lot to deal with, a lot that we need to figure out, what are some options out there for us to kind of think, okay, well, maybe we can get ahead of all this?
Yeah, so we're seeing people make major changes in their lives. Support for solutions to climate change are growing across the board in California and across the United States. And then there's cities like Los Angeles that release a Green New Deal back in April. One of the goals, for instance, is building a zero carbon electricity grid, which means 80% renewable energy supply by 2036, 100% renewable by 2045. There's a lot of other really ambitious things in that plan. That said, we have a long way to go before these big plans are actually realized.
That's KPCC's science reporter, Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks.
Thanks, A.
Keeping in that same vein, here with her prognostication for the coming year on the infrastructure beat is KPCC correspondent Sharon McNary. Hey, Sharon.
Hey there.
All right, the infrastructure beat can be a little tough to describe. It's energy, water, sewer, trash, disasters, the list goes on. I know you have your own way of putting it.
Yeah, I like to say I cover the things that we build together to make life better here in Southern California and the things that break. This next year, I'll be including a lot of things that climate change is messing up for us.
Oh, okay. So you have your eye on climate change, a big topic. What are you specifically looking at in 2020?
Our region has become vulnerable to fire due in part to climate change, and we're having to cope with that. So, for example, this year, for the first time, Southern California Edison imposed these public safety power shutoffs on wide areas of its service territory. Nearly 200,000 customers in high fire risk areas lost power over October and November. So in 2020, I'll be covering people's responses to those outages. They're pushing back on Edison, its communication, and its tactics in doing these shutoffs. But people are also coming up with creative ways to cope with these outages beyond just buying a noisy gas generator. I'm also seeing a lot of interest in microgrids, like these tiny power islands. I'll be covering one of those very soon. And then people who never had to deal with power outages, they're investing in tiny solar power systems to charge a battery that could, say, run a mini fridge and charge LED lights around your house.
Now, energy in California, a very important topic. It's driven much of your coverage over the past several years, including the gas blowout at Aliso Canyon. How do you expect our energy choices to maybe make news in 2020?
The Aliso Canyon gas leak was more than 4 years ago, but the effects keep rolling out. We'll be seeing the first trial starting next year, including some of the 36,000 individuals and businesses from Porter Ranch and other nearby areas who sued Southern California Gas Company over damages they say they sustained due to that blowout. And I'll also be looking in greater detail at the health problems and other issues people say they've experienced. But to the bigger picture, the disaster made our local policymakers realize that natural gas stored underground at high pressure is less reliable than people had previously thought. Angelenos and even the state legislature are rethinking where they get their energy. We're seeing that the state is pushing us to use less fossil fuels, including even natural gas. And officials are calling it decarbonization. It involves things like requiring new buildings and homes to be all electric, like with no gas stoves and no heaters. LA City Council and county governments have also issued these Green New Deal strategies that call for the eventual end of the use of natural gas. But that's only possible with the rise of more clean energy sources like solar and wind energy, and the efforts to create more battery storage to make all that energy available when the sun and wind aren't there. LADWP is even talking about transitioning to hydrogen-fueled power plant somewhere off in the future.
Got to ask, Sharon, how has SoCalGas been responding to all this?
SoCalGas is, of course, pushing back. They're lobbying local governments to try and keep natural gas to appear relevant. They term it balanced energy solutions. They got more than 100 local cities and even San Gabriel Valley Chinese restaurant chefs to sign on to pledges to keep using gas. I don't think you'll be seeing energy cops coming and dragging the gas stove out of your kitchen anytime soon, but there will be more discussions of alternatives of gas.
All right, so what are some other big topics you'll be taking up in the coming year?
Trash and recycling is a big one, and that's because the global market in recyclable materials has just turned upside down. China had been the biggest buyer of the stuff you put in your blue recycling bin, but about a year or two ago, they said, nope, we're only taking the cleanest, most valuable recyclables. So a lot of what trash haulers had been able to sell overseas no longer has much value. The price of aluminum is down. Single-use plastics have really no place to go besides the landfills. I'll be taking a closer look at what this means for Angelenos, what makes sense to put in the recycling, what doesn't, and what alternatives our trash haulers really have. I'll be looking at landfills, an incinerator, even new ways to get energy from the food we all throw out as California laws start requiring organic matter to be separated out of the landfill waste stream. I'll also be covering how all this is going to make it more expensive for Southern Californians to get rid of their trash and ways they can change their behavior to create less of it.
Now, speaking of organic things, this year you tore out your front yard grass to put in a vegetable garden because you thought it would be better for the environment. What's your big plan to help save the earth next year?
Well, in 2020, I'll be doing a thing called the Compact. It was started by some families in San Francisco about 10 years ago to save money and reduce their consumer footprint. And I don't spend money on anything new, except for necessities like gas for the car, underwear. So I can spend on services that support the local economy, like getting my hair cut. I also let myself spend money on raw materials to make things like clothing. But otherwise, I try to buy only used items. I can also barter or borrow things.
That sounds like an incredible challenge that I could never do.
Well, it is fun. I've done it a couple times. Usually I can make it several months without buying anything new. It's a good exercise to make me more thoughtful about where our consumer goods come from and about the environmental cost of getting them here. And I might do a story about it once I get farther along.
You're going to come back and share all of your stories about this with us here on Take Two. That's KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
We're going to continue with our year-end interviews after the break, this time looking at early childhood education. But before we get to that, we're going to hear how some of LA's more than 600,000 Filipinos are responding to the drastic anti-drug policies being pushed in their home country. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs is under international scrutiny for alleged human rights abuses. It's also drawn concern from Catholic leaders there and here in Los Angeles. KPCC's Aaron Schrank explores the divide between church and state in what is the largest Filipino community outside of the Philippines.
In his fourth annual State of the Nation address this summer, President Duterte defended his war on drugs and urged a joint session of the Philippines Congress to take it further.
I respectfully request Congress to reinstate the death penalty for heinous crimes related to drugs.
That same day, the sidewalk outside LA's Philippine consulate in Koreatown was flooded with protesters practicing their chants.
Hey, hey, Duterte! How many kids did you kill today?
Most of the hundreds here are with left-leaning Filipino-American activist groups who want the drug war to end. It's especially concerning for some Catholics in the crowd. The church opposes capital punishment. Naida Castro's here with a group called the National Ecumenical Forum for Filipino Concerns. She says it brings Filipino-American Christians together to be a voice for people back home.
Because in the Philippines, you know, when you criticize the government, you get killed. And that's why there are many priests who have been killed. And there are bishops who are being criticized and threatened.
Demonstrators read the names of people killed since Duterte's anti-drug crusade began in 2016.
Catalina Micah Opina, 3 years old, is now the youngest victim of the drug war in the Philippines.
According to official figures from the Philippine Drug Enforcement Agency, the death toll is about 5,500. The president's opposition says it's much higher, between 20 and 30,000. Ariana Rodriguez is a member of the women's rights group Gabriela LA and a lifelong Catholic.
What he's doing does not align with the Catholic faith, and is very easy for me personally to organize and feel confident that my church is behind me.
Rodriguez is a second-generation Filipino-American. The Catholic Church might be behind her, but not her Catholic parents.
We argue from both sides of this spectrum of we like Duterte, you know, I take the position of we don't like Duterte, but we both argue like, oh, my faith compels me to say this. So it can be hard.
Duterte has got to go!
Since taking office in 2016, Duterte has ratcheted up his attacks on the church, even charging some bishops with sedition. While many Catholic leaders in the Philippines condemn the drug killings, some are neutral or even supportive. Jail Cornelio is a sociologist of religion at Ateneo de Manila University. He asked church leaders in areas of the Philippines impacted by the drug war how they talk about it from the pulpit. The majority told him this.
The war on drugs is a necessary intervention, in fact, divinely ordained to cleanse Philippine society of its social ills.
The UN and International Criminal Court are looking into human rights abuses in the campaign. But many Filipinos feel like it's working. The criminals are dead. 78% of Filipinos say they're satisfied with Duterte's performance. Cornelio says when religious leaders talk about human rights, it goes over people's heads.
It's not the moral logic at work here. The moral logic at work is justice.
In September, local Filipino Catholics filled Our Lady of the Angels Cathedral to celebrate the Feast of the Virgin of Remedies, the patron saint of Pampanga. This image of Mary was introduced in the Philippine province as an anti-communist symbol. The Pope crowned the holy image in the 1950s. Expats in LA marked the anniversary with this special mass.
Viva Virgen de los Remedios!
Most people are wearing white. Some have elaborate banners and statues. Father Rodel Balagtas gives the homily.
We celebrate this mass to ask for the intercession of the Mother of God to bring remedy to all ills of division, hatred, corruption, drugs, and poverty in the Philippines, and to pray for a mutual understanding and respect between the state and the church.
After his message, Balagtas tells me the drug war is a touchy subject. Many in the pews support Duterte, some don't, and nobody really talks about it.
I see a real kind of a split level Christianity where you come to church and yet you live it differently in terms of all these moral issues, you know. Like, how can you be Catholic and not uphold basic human rights?
As Duterte's drug war continues, that's a question more Filipinos and Filipino-Americans will have to grapple with. Covering religion and diaspora, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Thank you. All right, now let's turn back to some of those conversations we were having with KPCC reporters about 2019 and how their beats are shaping up for 2020. Higher education, for one, had some of the highest highs and lowest lows in 2019. I mean, just think about the national college admission scandal, which had ground zero right here in Southern California. And along with that, there were some big pluses, like increases in funding for the state's public colleges and universities. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez has been looking back at the year that was. Welcome, Adolfo.
Thanks a lot.
All right, a lot going on in higher ed this year. What would you say is the biggest story of 2019?
Well, it depends on whether you're picking from the good news pile or the bad news pile. Out of the bad news pile, it's got to be the national college admissions scandal, which was revealed back in March.
Yeah, I thought you might say that. And that also bled into sports, UCLA, USC. So yeah, a lot going on there.
Well, we found out that the mastermind of all of this was a man by the name of Rick Singer out of Newport Beach, who promised admission to top universities and paid university employees, including at USC, UCLA, other campuses, to look the other way on fabricated applications. One of the schemes involved making up sports accomplishments that were then used in student applications and approved by some of the university administrators that you're talking about. Federal prosecutors charged dozens of parents, coaches, university administrators, Hollywood parents, and entrepreneurs, all with a lot of money to spare, and they use that money expecting favorable treatment on university admission.
Now, are all the court proceedings over?
Well, we've got lots of people who were charged who've pled guilty. Some have received prison time, and they've had to pay back as much as $100,000 in restitution. Actress Felicity Huffman, for example, pled guilty and was sentenced to 2 weeks in prison, 250 hours of community service, and has to pay back $30,000. Actress Lori Loughlin has held out. She hasn't taken the plea deal. So lots of focus is on her. Is she going to take a plea deal? Is she going to take this all the way to trial? Is she going to cave in? And is the judge going to make an example out of her?
What's been the response by some of the universities at the center of this? Any pledges to change how they do business?
Yeah, well, some of the universities fired or suspended some of the coaches and administrators after they were charged. And some campuses, like USC, say that they're adding more people on those decisions to admit athletic recruits, for example.
All right, so that was in the bad pile. What about higher ed good news pile?
Well, related to USC, Carol Folt took over as president over the summer. She's promising to make changes to make sure that nothing like this cheating scandal happens again. And also, on another note, the University of California and the Cal State University system are opening seats for some of the first time in recent memory after years of flat growth. There's more funding coming from Sacramento. At the California State University system, which is the largest university system in the nation, they are deep into this graduation effort, and they're saying that it's showing results. More students are starting at the Cal State system and ending up graduating 4 or 5 years later with a degree. A lot had dropped out in the past. And another thing that Cal State is doing that's going to affect, if it passes, it's going to affect a lot of high school students, is a plan that would increase the math requirement for admission. The university says that it's going to prepare students better when they get to their freshman year. But a growing number of groups say that this is actually going to have a detrimental effect on some of these high school students, that a lot of them are going to be left out. And Cal State is expected to make a decision on this in January.
Now, you've also been reporting about the challenges Native American students face in college. What have you found there?
Well, the numbers I've been finding are really troubling. The American Indian population is very large in California, especially in LA County, yet Native American enrollment at colleges and universities is really tiny compared to their population as a whole. Some universities, in order to address this, are appointing tribal liaisons to create a pathway for Native students from public schools to colleges, and that's working in places like Cal State San Bernardino, UCLA, and Cal State San Marcos. I talked to Native youth in college who've gone through various hardships, some of them financial, but also cultural. A lot of the hardships that people like you and me don't really face, and which is invisibility. They don't see themselves coming through public schools. They don't see themselves when they're in college. And right now is a critical time for California tribes. The population's growing, and tribes, especially those with casinos, they're growing businesses, and they've got other enterprises that they're running, and they need people with college degrees to run those operations. And a lot of Native Americans are left out in this effort. One of them is a very large group here in LA County, the Gabrielino Tongva. They don't have federal recognition, so that limits a lot of what they can do to advocate for themselves.
All right, turning to 2020, next year, California's two public university systems are going to have vacancies right at the top offices. UC President Janet Napolitano, Cal State Chancellor Tim White are both stepping down. Adolfo, what do the tea leaves say in terms of who fills these slots?
Well, you can't go wrong if you say that either an academic or a former politician or maybe somebody with a little bit of both of those characteristics is going to take over those slots. All you have to do is look at who holds the positions now. Tim White was an accomplished researcher. He became president of UC Riverside. Janet Napolitano was head of U.S. Department of Homeland Security. She was a governor of Arizona and former federal prosecutor. The salary is something important to look at, A, because it's bound to attract some people with national recognition. Napolitano's making about $580,000 a year. Tim White is making about $460,000 a year. But whoever it is, they're going to be making lots of trips to Sacramento to lobby for more money from legislators and the governor. Funding's still a big issue at the four-year universities, public universities, as both systems say that they're barely getting back to the money they were getting before the recession in 2008.
Adolfo Guzman Lopez reports on higher education for KPCC and LAS. Adolfo, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, now to our littlest students, and we have a new face and voice on the early childhood education beat. Mariana Dale started a few weeks ago and is here to tell us what she'll be looking to cover next year. Hi.
Hi.
Now, tell us about yourself. People got to get to know you.
Well, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and that's where I was before I came here. I worked at the NPR station there, reporting on a little bit of everything. Most recently, it was education, but we had a statewide teacher strike last year, so that was a big deal. And I've also answered a lot of our listeners' questions about history, about Japanese internment, and about one of my favorite things, which is saguaro cactus.
All right, so you're used to working a busy beat. And early childhood is a busy one here in California. It was even part of Governor Gavin Newsom's inaugural address, which he gave in part holding his toddler son.
We will support parents. They need support. Trust me. So that they can give their kids the love and care that they need.
And so at this point, you should know that Governor Newsom's son, Dutch, is kind of just wandering around the stage with his pacifier in his mouth. He's dragging his blanket with him.
Especially in those critical early years of life.
Yep, those are some critical early years. And actually, several months later, Newsom signed the state's budget. It includes almost $5.6 billion for young children and their families. Mariana, you tell me, that sounds like a lot of money.
That number is incredibly overwhelming. I don't care who you are. And a part of my job is actually to try and figure out what that actually means for families and educators here in Los Angeles. And I've been doing some research, and I found a few examples from the budget that I think help explain what that money pays for. So there's some new funding for parents who qualify for childcare through CalWORKs and some other state programs. For example, the Marguerite Casey Foundation actually estimates there's enough for 12,400 more kids that are going to be covered by what's called the Alternative Payment Program. Now, another aspect of early childhood is actually health. And so more and more we're hearing about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. They can negatively affect kids even much later in their lives. And so starting in January, children covered by Medi-Cal are going to be eligible for free trauma screenings to try and kind of catch that early.
And also there could be some changes coming for people and the businesses that take care of kids too. So tell us about that.
Yeah, there's almost $500 million of that number you mentioned earlier that's actually going to help childcare centers expand their operations, also provide some training for childcare workers. Right now, though, it's kind of unclear how exactly that money is going to be distributed and who's going to get it. So we're going to be watching that. Another big development that's really been years in the making is that workers who care for some kids in low-income families now have the right to bargain with the state for more money and benefits. There's going to be an election next year where workers get to vote on who's going to represent them in those negotiations.
So will this make it any easier to find quality, affordable childcare?
That's really the biggest question of this whole beat. And I think if I had the answer, there wouldn't be so much work for me to do. But what I can say is it seems like the state is really taking steps toward making it more available, but it's just not enough yet. And I'm talking to parents, policymakers, educators, and they just say that it's a matter of dollar and cents. There's just not enough money there to provide early childhood care for every kid that doesn't have it right now.
Now, the person who had the job before you, Priska Neely, she spent a lot of time reporting on infant mortality among African Americans. Black babies in LA County are three times more likely than white children to die before their first birthday. Do you have any plans to continue that work?
Absolutely. I have big shoes to fill. My first feature for the station was actually about a program that was meant to help LA County Black moms have healthier births and kind of how that program fell apart. So just like those statistics you mentioned about Black infants, Black mothers also have higher health risks than other populations. They're more likely to die from complications of pregnancy, have their babies early, or have a C-section. And next year, something I'm going to be looking at more closely is doulas. Here's how Glendale-based doula Hannah Halliwell describes her work.
I say that doulas are advocates for you in your pregnancy and your birth process and in your postpartum, should you choose to have us around for that.
And postpartum, that's, for example, they can help you with things like breastfeeding. And this reporting is really going to be shaped by what people want to know. So if anyone has any questions, you should definitely send them my way. They might be part of the story.
All right. So we're all about listener engagement here at KPCC. So what else do you want people to know about your reporting?
Absolutely. And I totally agree with that philosophy. That's why I'm here. So like I said, I'm not from Los Angeles and I'm actually not a parent myself. So I feel like I have double the amount to learn. I really want to hear from people about questions that they have about their child's development, about preschool, about birth and parenting. I know a lot of parents are just trying to get through the day, but if we can be a resource for you all, we definitely want to be. So you can email me, you can find me on social media, and I'm basically in all the places that you can find KPCC and LAS stories.
That's KPCC's Mariana Dale. Mariana, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, coming up, the woman who helped bring the Dodgers to LA, and wait till you hear what might have been built in the spot where Dodger Stadium stands if she hadn't. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez.
For many in LA who are big Dodger fans, there's usually one particular era they hold dear. Now, for me, it was the Fernando Valenzuela Oral Hershiser Dodgers of the 80s with Kurt Gibson's home run as the exclamation point.
High fly ball into right field. She is.
For my dad, he loved telling me stories about how Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale and Maury Wills dominated his childhood.
And Sandy Koufax, whose name will always remind you of strikeouts, did it with a flourish. He struck out the last six consecutive batters.
And for younger generations, they'll one day be talking about Clayton Kershaw and Cody Bellinger. The point is, the Dodgers are one of LA's cultural ties that binds generations of Angelenos together. And they wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for the efforts of former L.A. City Councilwoman Rosalind Wyman. Her story, along with many others, is also told in Dodger Stories, Six Decades in L.A. on PBS SoCal and KCET. And Roz Wyman has been kind enough to invite us into her home. Roz, thanks for having us out.
I'm really glad to have you. I've known you, I feel, with all your great radio work and your connection to the Dodgers, so I'm pleased to have you in my home.
Now, Roz, the Cliff Notes version of the Dodgers moving to L.A., Walter O'Malley had some trouble in New York getting a stadium. He moved his team here from Brooklyn in 1958, but it wasn't completely out of the blue. Take us back to 1953, Roz. You were a 22-year-old city council member, the youngest of all time. Why did you feel first that L.A. needed a Major League Baseball team?
Well, my mother, believe it or not, in my family was a huge baseball fan. Born in Chicago, she was a Cubs fan, and her brothers played, you know, on weekends, they played those, the groups would get together and they'd play ball.
Oh, yeah, Sunday leagues.
Sunday
sure,
leagues,
yeah.
And they weren't very good, but they loved baseball. But when I decided to run for office, I realized that my city was, in my opinion, quote unquote, not big league. Because number one, we didn't have a major league football team at that time. We didn't have a major league baseball team, and we certainly didn't have a basketball team. I decided, how do you get a major league baseball team in L.A.? And I must say, I didn't know how complicated it was at all.
Well, you were 22 years old, Roz. I mean, you weren't a veteran politician yet.
I just thought you sat down, maybe invited somebody to come. I didn't know the baseball rules. I didn't know about territory at that time. I didn't know that the major league organization that ran Major League Baseball had to approve it. I mean, I didn't know any of those
things.
That's
a good thing now that I think about it, Roz, because you weren't encumbered by all of these preconceived ideas about what would make a major league team move to L.A., right? You just were like, well, why not?
Well, at that point, I think the Braves had just moved, and I read about that.
From Boston to Milwaukee, right.
Right, yeah. Boston to Milwaukee, you're right. And I thought, well, somebody moved, and so maybe I can find another team. Now, I must say, up to the day we voted, I really didn't think I could ever get the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Okay.
The Brooklyn Dodgers to Brooklyn was everything. Yeah. I mean, they were just worshipped.
Yeah.
And it also was the best sports team in America, whether it was football, baseball, or hockey, or whatever it was, considered the finest sports organization in America.
They were beloved in Brooklyn, and Walter O'Malley was the owner. And you sent a letter. You mentioned sending letters. You sent a letter to Walter O'Malley. What did he respond?
Walter O'Malley couldn't have cared less than my letter. He often said to me later, I just thought you guys were, you know, wants a publicity, and you were using the Dodgers as publicity. And I was serious, and I cared a lot, and I had done a little of the history of it in L.A., and the only person who seemed to care was the sports writers, who cared a lot. And one other elected official, Supervisor Kenny Hahn, cared. He was in the city council and had gone to the Board of Supervisors, so he helped me as a elected official from the Board of Supervisors. It was clear that where the Brooklyn Dodgers were, they had to move. Ebbets Field had no parking. They were landlocked. And he had looked at a couple of other spots in New York and was blocked every single time by a commissioner in the city
Robert
of New
Moses.
York. Robert
yeah.
Moses.
Very
he was
powerful
very,
man, too.
He was only a park commissioner. I kept saying, how's a park commissioner this important that he can block? And so, but I kept plodding away. I kept trying and trying and trying. I couldn't get O'Malley to come out here. And then he had to come out for a meeting after the World Series and after all of that sort of stuff. And he came out, and I was away of all times. And Kenny Hahn, they got a helicopter, and they put Walter in this helicopter.
The sheriff's helicopter.
Sheriff's
actually,
helicopter.
Let's hear Kenny Hahn's son, former mayor James Hahn, talk about that.
Kenny Hahn had the sheriff's helicopter. Couldn't do this today, by the way. So it would be some kind of scandal. Got the sheriff's helicopter to fly O'Malley around.
O'Malley was the one who spotted Chavez Ravine because he saw all the freeways coming up. For a guy from New York, where nobody really drove, to understand how important cars were in Los Angeles, I think that was O'Malley's genius.
We're speaking with former L.A. City Councilwoman Roz Wyman. She's part of the new film Dodgers Stories, 6 decades in L.A. Okay, so two big things happen here. The Dodgers decide to move to L.A., and they're going to play in the Coliseum while Dodger Stadium is being built. In 1959, though, the Dodgers wound up winning the World Series, their first of five in Los Angeles. When they became champs, what was the feeling in the city? I mean, you went through all this effort, Ross, to bring them here. The very second year, they're champs.
First in L.A., when we walked down the stairs of the Coliseum, we got booed. O'Malley and I got booed. And we said, we aren't going to sit here too long in the second year. But what happened, Vince Scully, the town fell in love with. He was magical for us. He really, in my opinion, made the Dodgers the first success we really had despite the team. Mm-hmm. But when we had the second year, and at the end of that series, and he said, now we go to Chicago, this town, for the first time in my career and in many people, we heard horns were blown in the east side, the San Fernando Valley, downtown. And when Scully said, and now we go to Chicago, and I felt as an elected official, it was the first thing that my city came together. And they really seemed to care.
Ross, I've always made the argument that before the Dodgers got here, L.A. was, in a way, disconnected from the rest of America. The U.S. Was obsessed with Major League Baseball, and as you mentioned, it wasn't further west than St. Louis, Kansas City that Major League Baseball extended. The Dodgers, I think, became that bridge and became an indicator that L.A. was a real grown-up city, not some wacky western outpost, the capital of the movie-making business. Ross, you were here for their arrival. You've been here through the entire time they've been here. What do you think, ultimately, the Dodgers have done for Los Angeles?
I believe the Dodgers' move opened up the city, and people looked at us differently. They knew we had a Major League Baseball team, and they followed it. Anybody who followed baseball across the country knew that the Brooklyn Dodgers are now the Los Angeles Dodgers. And in fact, there was no San Diego team at that point. There was no Oakland team. We really opened the West for baseball for what we did. I felt that the Dodgers made us really a major league part of America, and that the Brooklyn Dodgers, having moved, was such a shock, really a shock to sports. And then, of course, we got the Rams. They came along.
It became our marker of where we're growing up.
And in fact, people today will say, how come the Lakers are called the Lakers? And the reason we got them from Minnesota. That's how we got them.
I have to talk to you about that for another movie, another Roz Wyman movie.
I'll talk to you how we got the Lakers here.
That's former L.A. City Councilwoman Rosalind Wyman. She was instrumental in bringing the Dodgers to Los Angeles from Brooklyn back in the 1950s, and she's been sharing that history with us. The rest of our conversation continues right after the break, so keep your ears right here.
So I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ian Martinez. The Dodgers are one of L.A.'s cultural ties that binds generations of Angelenos together. And they wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for the efforts of former L.A. City Councilwoman Rosalind Wyman. Her story, along with many others, was told in Dodgers Stories, 6 Decades in L.A., which premiered on KCT last month. The film features Dodger fans sharing what going to games has meant to them. So when I sat down with Roz, I played her Ann Perez, who was holding a teeny tiny Fernando Valenzuela jersey.
So this is the Dodgers outfit that I bought my son when he was a baby, that he used to wear when he was a baby, when it was Fernando Mania. And I saved it all these years. My first grandson was just born a month ago, and this has now been passed on to him, so he will be wearing this to games now. But I'm excited because he's third generation Dodger. Actually, fourth generation, because my mom was a fan too, but this is going on to the next generation and then hopefully to the next generation after that.
4 generations of Dodger fans, Roz. Team historian Mark Langell says LA would not be the way it is without you. How does it feel, Roz, to be the reason why so many millions of people, millions of Angelenos throughout LA, have all these cherished memories going back 60 years? You are the reason for it.
They're just kind. It's nice to hear it at this stage of my life that people say good things, but I'll tell you, a lot of people were screaming and yelling at me, why are you doing this at the time? But again, the Fernando story is a great story. Walter O'Malley said he hoped that we could have a hero in the Latino community because of Los Angeles being so close to Mexico and the area. he was an owner who really cherished the team. I love that story because so many people of different ethnic backgrounds have taken on the Dodgers. Nobody more than the Latino community and certainly our African American community. You know, if you could be a part of something and you served and you got something good, it's nice to hear it. But in other words, because of the foundation of the Dodgers, we built parks for the kids to play at, especially in the inner cities. One of the things I'm disappointed that we don't have more African-Americans playing baseball. Latinos are many, many more. I just think sports are open for everybody. And Los Angeles being where we are situated, it makes a great story for our community, and it's just nice to hear nice things said about you. I assure you there's some that will not say nice things because it's just part of life, and then I've taken part in politics. And when I get into a fight, just mention something about politics. So, I mean, I've had a lot of ups and downs in my political career, and I've had a wonderful life. The only thing sad in my life, I lost my husband at a very, very young age. But I had three great kids, and now I've got three great grandkids, one and more. But that's why I do things with a lot of kids. I like to have kids around.
I think you would count the L.A. Dodgers as another kid. That's former L.A. City Councilwoman Rosalind Wyman, part of the film Dodgers Stories, 6 decades in L.A. Roz, thank you very much for having us in your home.
It's my delight to have and share this with you. You've been a part of the Dodgers, and that's great. And that you're interviewing me makes it even better.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 oh.
We close today with a story about the USO, an organization still mostly associated with entertainers of the past. The USO still travels the world to put on live variety shows for military troops. And though Bob Hope is gone, actress Anne Margaret still appears, as do a number of other celebrities. But in an era of streaming media on demand, how relevant are today's shows? KPCC's Austin Cross has a story for the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans.
Washington, D.C., make some noise, though!
At the Anthem Auditorium in Washington, D.C., 1,100 members from all branches of the military settle in for an evening with the trappings of home. Hot dogs, comedy, and country music.
D.C., you better crank this up!
It's a modern version of the shows the USO started putting on nearly 8 decades ago, at a very different time in American history.
Howdy do, fellas. This is Bob, Command Performance Hope, telling each Nazi that's in Russia today that Crimea doesn't pay.
The USO got its start before the U.S. formally entered World War II. When war came, Bob Hope was one of the most famous comedians at the time. He entertained the troops from the Southwest Pacific to the European theater. He continued through Korea, Vietnam, and the first Gulf War.
When I went with Bob, there were 85 of us.
Actress Anne Margaret performed alongside Bob Hope in 1968.
There were hairdressers and makeup people and thousands of men and women just sitting in the sun waiting for us to perform.
Anne Margaret, right here.
Anne Margaret was honored at the Washington event for her service to the USO. But the event wasn't just about the past. It's about spotlighting what the USO is doing now. Yes, there are still shows, but USO President and CEO J.D. Crouch says it's about more than that. He says the USO improves the well-being of service members by reminding them that somebody back home hasn't forgotten about them.
The big challenge of military life for these people, men and women, it's not sort of fear of battle or those sorts of things, which us ordinary civilians might think. It's separation.
In America, a lot's changed since the days of Bob Hope. Around 12% of the country served during World War II. Today, less than 1% of the country is on active duty. Mary Beth Ulrich at the U.S. Army War College says that's affected the troops.
That leads to a perception that they are carrying the burden for the country, and increasingly the perception that this is something that other people do, the people in the service being those other people.
Battling those perceptions is now part of the USO's latest mission. To that end, 400 civilians were welcomed to the show. For some, like D.C. resident Daniel Kleinbaum, it was their first exposure to the USO.
I mean, I've heard the name, but I was walking by earlier and saw that there was an event going on, so looked it up and then decided to come back a few hours later.
Once inside, civilians were given a rare glimpse of military life. USO Senior Operations Manager Emily Flint.
So this is a USO center mimicking what it would look like if you were in a center in Iraq. So we have the comforts of home, you know, the couches, the pillows, the blankets. We have a TV system over here with a PS4, and actually two service members are playing right now.
In the back, there's a refrigerator full of sodas and a corner where service members can record books for their kids. Marine Corporal Justin Countryman.
You may not have talked to your family for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. You maybe haven't had a good meal in, you know, 2 months. And you walk into a USO, and the bare minimum, you have at least a phone call. They're just, it's welcoming. You know what I mean? It's warm.
The civilians here at the Anthem were also treated to a staple in the USO experience, the show. For one of the headliners, comedian Paula Poundstone, it was a different experience to perform for a largely military crowd.
It is a little bit daunting, to be honest with you. You know, this is a person who's been through something that I couldn't possibly understand. And how now do I relate to them? And I think the answer is just be a human being.
Keep it going, keep it going, keep it going.
A lot has changed in the last 80 years. But to service members, a soda, a laugh, and a hot meal still go a long way when they're far from home.
So thank you, thank you, thank you for your service.
In Washington, I'm Austin Cross.
All right, that's it for Take Two today. We're off tomorrow, but we will be back on the 26th. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. This is Take Two.